You're listening to a talk by Richard Stallman of the Free Software Foundation on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXE Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests.
The non-free part will always deny the freedom to the free parts if they're combined. So to make sure that the software stays free, we have to insist that people can't strip off the freedom just by changing the program. In fact, the idea of copyleft is that nobody can strip off the freedom. Wherever the program goes, the freedom goes with it, so that every user who gets the program gets the freedom as well. The freedoms to change and redistribute this program become inalienable rights, a concept from the Declaration of Independence, rights that we make sure can't be taken away from you. Of course, the specific license that embodies the idea of copyleft is the GNU General Public License, a controversial license because it actually has the strength to say no to people who would be parasites on our community. There are lots of people who don't appreciate the ideals of freedom and would be very glad to take the work that we have done and use it to get a head start in distributing a non-free program and tempting people to give up their freedom. And the result would be, you know, if we let people do that, that we would be developing these free programs and we constantly have to compete with improved versions of our own programs. That's no fun. And a lot of people also feel, you know, I'm willing to volunteer my time to contribute to the community, but why should I volunteer my time to contribute to that company's, to improving that company's proprietary program? You know, some people might not think that that's evil, but they want to get paid if they're going to do that. I personally would rather not do it at all. But both of these groups of people, both the ones like me who say, I don't want to help that non-free program get a foothold in our community, and the ones who say, sure, I'd work for them, but then they better pay me, both of us have a good reason to use the GNU General Public License. Because that says to that company, you can't just take my work and distribute it without the freedom. Whereas the non-copyleft licenses, like the X-Windows license, do permit that. So that is the big division between the two categories of free software. License-wise, there are the programs that are copylefted so that the license defends the freedom of the software for every user, and there are the non-copylefted programs for which non-free versions are allowed. Somebody can take those programs and strip off the freedom. You may get that program in a non-free version, and that problem exists today. There are still non-free versions of X-Windows being used on our free operating systems. There is even hardware which is not really supported except by a non-free version of X-Windows. And that's a major problem in our community. Nonetheless, I won't say that X-Windows is a bad thing. You know, I'd say the developers did not do the best possible thing that they could have done, but they did release a lot of software that we could all use. You know, there's a big difference between less than perfect and evil. There are many gradations of good and bad. We have to resist the temptation to say, if you didn't do the absolute best possible thing, then you're no good. You know, the people who developed X-Windows made a big contribution to our community, but there's something better that they could have done. They could have copylefted parts of the program and prevented those freedom-denying versions from being distributed by others. The fact that the GNU General Public License defends your freedom, uses copyright law to defend your freedom, is, of course, the reason why Microsoft is attacking it today. See, Microsoft would really like to be able to take all the code that we wrote and put it into proprietary programs, have somebody make some improvements or even just incompatible changes is all they need. You know, with Microsoft's marketing clout, they don't need to make it better to have their version supplant ours. They just have to make it different and incompatible, and then put it on everybody's desktop. They really don't like the GNU GPL because the GNU GPL won't let them do that. It doesn't allow embrace and extend. It says, if you want to share our code in your programs, you can, but you've got to share and share alike. The changes that you make, we have to be allowed to share. So it's two-way cooperation, which is real cooperation. Many companies, even big companies like IBM and HP, are willing to use our software on this basis. IBM and HP contribute substantial improvements to GNU software. And they develop other free software. Microsoft doesn't want to do that, so they give it out that businesses just can't deal with the GPL. Well, if businesses don't include IBM and HP and so on, then maybe they're right. More about that later. I should finish the historical story. You see, we set out in 1984 not just to write some free software, but to do something much more coherent, to develop an operating system that was entirely free software. So that meant we had to write piece after piece after piece. Of course, we were always looking for shortcuts. The job was so big, people said we'd never be able to finish it. And I thought there was at least a chance we'd finish it, but obviously it's worth looking for shortcuts. So we kept looking around, is there any program that somebody else has written that we could manage to adapt to plug into here, and that way we won't have to write it from scratch. For instance, the X window system. It's true it wasn't copylefted, but it was free software, so we could use it. Now, I had wanted to put a window system into GNU from day one. I wrote a couple of window systems at MIT before I started GNU. And so even though Unix had no window system in 1984, I decided GNU would have one. We never ended up writing a GNU window system because X came along. And I said, goody, one big job we don't have to do. We'll use X. We fit in these pieces. In October 1985, we founded the Free Software Foundation. So please note, the GNU project came first. The Free Software Foundation came after, about almost 2 years after the announcement of the project. And the Free Software Foundation is a tax-exempt charity that raises funds to promote the freedom to share and change software. And in the 1980s, one of the main things we did with our funds was hire people to write parts of GNU. And essential programs were written this way, as well as parts of other programs. And so we were approaching our goal. By 1991, there was just one major piece missing, and that was the kernel. Now, why did I put off the kernel? Partly because it doesn't really matter what order you do the things in, at least technically it doesn't. You've got to do them all anyway. And partly because I hoped we'd be able to find a start at a kernel somewhere else. It didn't work out that way. But fortunately, our community did not have to wait for the GNU kernel, because in 1991, Linus Torvalds developed another free kernel called Linux. And he used the old-fashioned monolithic design, and it turns out that he got his working much faster than we got ours working. So maybe that's one of the mistakes I made in that design decision. At first, we didn't know about Linux because he never contacted us to talk about it, although he did know about the GNU project. But he announced it to other people in other places on the net. And so other people then did the work of combining Linux with the rest of the GNU system to make a complete free operating system, essentially to make the GNU plus Linux combination. But they didn't realize that's what they were doing. You see, they said, we have a kernel. Let's look around and see what other pieces we can find to put together with the kernel. So they looked around, and lo and behold, everything they needed was already available. What good fortune, they said. It's all here. we can find everything we need. We'll just take all these different things and put them together and have a system. They didn't know that most of what they'd found was pieces of the GNU system. So they didn't realize that they were fitting Linux into the gap in the GNU system. They thought they were taking Linux and making a system out of Linux. So they called it a Linux system. Although, at this point, thousands of people and projects have contributed to the system. There's one project which is the reason the system exists, and that's the GNU project. It is basically the GNU system with other things added. However, the practice of calling the system Linux has been a great blow to the GNU project because we don't normally get credit for what we've done. I think Linux, the kernel, is a very useful piece of free software, and I have only good things to say about it. But, well, actually, I can find a few bad things to say about it. But basically, I have good things to say about it. However, the practice of calling the GNU system Linux is just a mistake. I'd like to ask you, please, to make the small effort necessary to call the system GNU/Linux, and that way, to help us get a share of the credit. We have one. We have one. We have an animal. A GNU. Anyway, so yeah, when you draw a penguin, draw a GNU next to it. But let's save the questions for the end. I have more to go through. Why am I so concerned about this? You know, why do I think it's worth bothering you and perhaps giving you perhaps lowering your opinion of me to raise this issue of credit? Because, you know, some people, when I do this, some people think that it's because I want my ego to be fed, right? Of course, I'm not saying calling, I'm not asking you to call it Stallmanix, right? I'm asking you to call it GNU because I want the GNU project to get credit, and there's a very specific reason for that, which is a lot more important than anybody getting credit in and of itself. You see, these days, if you look around in our community, most of the people talking about and writing about it don't ever mention GNU, and they don't ever mention these goals of freedom, these political and social ideals either, because the place they come from is GNU. The ideas associated with Linux, the philosophy, is very different. It's basically the apolitical philosophy of Linus Torvalds. So when people think that the whole system is Linux, they tend to think, oh, it must have been all started by Linus Torvalds. His philosophy must be the one that we should look at carefully. And when they hear about the GNU philosophy, they say, boy, this is so idealistic. This must be awfully impractical. I'm a Linux user, not a GNU user. What irony. You know, if only they knew. If they knew that the system they like, or in some cases love and go wild over, is our idealistic political philosophy made real, they still wouldn't have to agree with us, but at least they'd see a reason to take it seriously. To think about it carefully, to give it a chance. They would see how it relates to their lives. You know, if they realized, I'm using the GNU system, here's the GNU philosophy, this philosophy is why the system that I like very much exists, they'd at least consider it with a much more open mind. Doesn't mean everybody will agree. People think different things. That's okay. You know, people should make up their own minds. But I want this philosophy to get the benefit of the credit for the results it has achieved. If you look around in our community, you'll find that almost everywhere, the institutions are calling the system Linux. You know, reporters mostly call it Linux. It's not right, but they do. The companies mostly say that package the system. Oh, and most of these reporters, when they write articles, they usually don't look at it as a political issue or social issue. They're usually looking at it purely as a business question, or what companies are going to succeed more or less, which is really a fairly minor question for society. And if you look at the companies that package the GNU/Linux system for people to use, well, most of them call it Linux, and they all add non-free software to it. See, the GNU GPL says that if you take code and some code out of a GPL-covered program and add some more code to make a bigger program, that whole program has to be released under the GPL. But you can put other separate programs on the same disk or the same of either kind, hard disk or CD, and they can have other licenses. That's considered mere aggregation, and essentially just distributing two programs to somebody at the same time is not something we have any say over. So, in fact, it's not true. Sometimes I wish it were true that if a company uses a GPL-covered program in a product, that the whole product has to be free software. It's not. It doesn't go to that range, that scope. It's the whole program. If they're two separate programs that communicate with each other at arm's length, you know, like by sending messages to each other, then they're legally separate in general. So these companies, by adding the non-free software to the system, are giving the users philosophically and politically a very bad idea. They're telling the users it's okay to use non-free software. We're even putting it on this as a bonus. If you look at the magazines about the use of the GNU/Linux system, most of them have a title like Linux something or other. So they're calling the system Linux most of the time. And they're filled with ads for non-free software that you could run on top of the GNU/Linux system. Now, those ads have a common message. They say, non-free software is good for you. It's so good, you might even pay to get it. And they call these things value-added packages, which makes a statement about their values. They're saying, value practical convenience, not freedom. And I don't agree with those values, so I call them freedom subtracted packages. Because if you have installed a free operating system and you now are living in the free world, you enjoy the benefits of liberty that we worked for so many years to give you, those packages give you an opportunity to buckle on a chain. Then if you look at the trade shows about the use of the dedicated to the GNU/Linux system, they all call themselves Linux shows, and they're filled with booths exhibiting non-free software, essentially putting the seal of approval on the non-free software. So almost everywhere you look in our community, the institutions are endorsing the non-free software, totally negating the idea of freedom that GNU was developed for. And the only place people are likely to come across the ideal of freedom is in connection with GNU and in connection with free software, the term free software. So this is why I ask you, please call the system GNU/Linux. Please make people aware where the system came from and why. Of course, just by using that name, you won't be making an explanation of the history. You can type four extra characters and write GNU/Linux. You can say two extra syllables, but GNU/Linux is fewer syllables than Windows 2000. But you're not telling them a lot, but you're preparing them so that when they hear about GNU and what it's all about, they'll see how that connects to them and their lives. And that indirectly makes a tremendous difference. So please help us. You'll note that Microsoft called the GPL an open source license. They don't want people to be thinking in terms of freedom as the issue. You'll find that they invite people to think in a narrow way as consumers, and of course not even think very rationally as consumers if they're going to choose Microsoft products. But they don't want people to think as citizens or statesmen. That's inimical to them. At least it's inimical to their current business model. How does free software. I've been talking about how free software relates to our society. A secondary topic that might be of interest to some of you is how free software relates to business. Now, in fact, free software is tremendously useful for business. After all, most businesses in the advanced countries use software. Only a tiny fraction of them develop software. And free software is tremendously advantageous for any company that uses software because it means that you are in control. Basically, free software means the users are in control of what the program does, either individually if they care enough to be, or collectively when they care enough to be. Whoever cares enough can exert some influence. If you don't care, you don't bother. Then you use what other people prefer. But if you do care, then you have some say. With proprietary software, you have essentially no say. With free software, you can change what you want to change. And it doesn't matter if there are no programmers in your company. That's fine. You know, if you wanted to move the walls in your building, you don't have to be a carpentry company. You just have to be able to go find a carpenter and say, what will you charge to do this job? And if you want to change around the software you use, you don't have to be a programming company. You just have to go to a programming company and say, what will you charge to implement these features and when will you have it done? And if they don't do the job, you can go find somebody else. There's a free market for support. So any business that cares about support will find a tremendous advantage in free software. With proprietary software, support is a monopoly because one company has the source code, or maybe a small number of companies that paid a gigantic amount of money have the source code if it's Microsoft's shared source program. But it's very few. And so there aren't very many possible sources of support for you. And that means that unless you're a real giant, they don't care about you. Your company is not important enough for them to care if they lose your business or what happens. Once you're using the program, they figure you're locked in to getting the support from them because to switch to a different program is a gigantic job. You end up with things like paying for the privilege of reporting a bug. And once you've paid, they tell you, well, okay, we've noted your bug report. In a few months, you can buy an upgrade and you'll see if we fixed it. Support providers for free software can't get away with that. They have to please the customers. Of course, you can get a lot of good support gratis. You post your problem on the internet, you may get an answer the next day. But that's not guaranteed, of course. If you want to be confident, you better make an arrangement with a company and pay them. And this is, of course, one of the ways that free software business works. Another advantage of free software for businesses that use software is security and privacy. And this applies to individuals as well, but I brought it up in the context of businesses. You see, when a program is proprietary, you can't even tell what it really does. It could have features deliberately put in that you wouldn't like if you knew about them. Like it might have a back door to let the developer get into your machine. It might snoop on what you do and send information back. This is not unusual. Some Microsoft software did this, but it's not only Microsoft. There are other proprietary programs that snoop on the user. And you can't even tell if it does this. And of course, even assuming the developer is totally honest, every programmer makes mistakes. There could be bugs that affect your security, which are nobody's fault. But the point is, if it's not free software, you can't find them and you can't fix them. Nobody has the time to check the source of every program he runs. You're not going to do that. But with free software, there's a large community and there are people in that community who are checking things. And you get the benefit of their checking. Because if there's an accidental bug, there surely are from time to time in any program, they might find it and fix it. And people are much less likely to put in a deliberate Trojan horse or snooping feature if they think they might get caught. the proprietary software developers figure they won't get caught. They'll get away with it undetected. But a free software developer has to figure people will look at that and see it's there. So in our community, we don't feel we can get away with ramming a feature down the user's throats that the users wouldn't like. Because we know that if the users don't like it, they'll make a modified version which doesn't have it. And then they'll all start using that version. In fact, we can all reason enough, we can all figure this out enough steps ahead that we probably won't put in that feature. We want, after all, you're writing a free program, you want people to like your version. You don't want to put in a thing that you know a lot of people are going to hate and have another modified version catch on instead of yours. So you just, you realize that the user is king in the world of free software. In the world of proprietary software, the customer is not king. Because you're only a customer. You have no say in the software you use. In this respect, free software is a new mechanism for democracy to operate. Professor Lessig, now at Stanford, noted that code functions as a kind of law. Whoever gets to write the code that just about everybody uses, for all intents and purposes, is writing the laws that run people's lives. With free software, these laws get written in a democratic way, not the classical form of democracy. We don't have a big election and say, everybody vote, which way should this feature be done? Instead, we say, basically, those of you who want to work on implementing the feature this way, do it. And if you want to work on implementing the feature that way, do it. And it gets done one way or the other, you know. And so if a lot of people want it this way, it'll get done this way. So in this way, everybody contributes to the social decision by simply taking steps in the direction he wants to go. And you're free to take as many steps personally as you want to take. A business is free to commission as many steps as they find it useful to take. And add all these things up, and that says which direction the software goes. And it's often very useful to be able to take pieces out of some existing program, presumably usually large pieces, of course, and then write a certain amount of code of your own and make a program that does exactly what you need, which would have cost an arm and a leg to develop if you had to write it all from scratch, if you couldn't cannibalize large pieces from some existing free software package. Another thing that results from the fact that the user is king is that we tend to be very good about compatibility and standardization. Why? Because users like that. Users are likely to reject a program that has gratuitous incompatibilities in it. Now, sometimes there's a certain group of users which actually have a need for a certain kind of incompatibility. And then they'll have it. That's okay. But when what users want is to follow a standard, we developers have to follow it, and we know that, and we do it. By contrast, if you look at proprietary software developers, they often find it advantageous to deliberately not follow a standard. And not because they think that they're giving the user an advantage that way, but rather because they're imposing on the user, locking the user in. And you'll even find them making changes in their file formats from time to time just to force people to get the newest version. Archivists are finding a problem now that files written on computers 10 years ago often can't be accessed. They were written with proprietary software that's essentially lost now. If it were written with free software, then it could be brought up to date and run. And those things would not, those records would not be lost, would not be inaccessible. They were even complaining about this on NPR recently and citing free software as the solution. And so, in effect, by using a non-free program to store your own data, you're putting your head in the noose. So I've talked about how free software affects most business, but how does it affect that particular narrow area, which is software business? Well, the answer is mostly not at all. And the reason is that 90% of the software industry, from what I'm told, is development of custom software, software that's not meant to be released at all. For custom software, this issue, the ethical issue of free or proprietary, doesn't arise. You see, the issue is, are you users free to change and redistribute the software? If there's only one user and that user owns the rights, there's no problem. That user is free to do all these things. So in effect, any custom program that was developed by one company for use in-house is free software, as long as they had the sense to insist on getting the source code and all the rights. And the issue doesn't really arise for software that goes in a watch or a microwave oven or an automobile ignition system, because those are places where you don't download software to install. It's not a real computer as far as the user is concerned. And so it doesn't raise these issues enough for them to be ethically important. So for the most part, the software industry will go along just as it's been going. And the interesting thing is, there's, since such a large fraction of the jobs are in that part of the industry, even if there were no possibilities for free software business, the developers of free software could all get day jobs writing custom software. There are so many, you know, the ratio is so big. But as it happens, there is free software business. There are free software companies. And of course, there are also companies which are not free software businesses, but do develop useful pieces of free software to release. And the free software that they produce is substantial. Now, how do free software businesses work? Well, some of them sell copies. You know, you're free to copy it, but they can still sell thousands of copies a month. And others sell support and various kinds of services. I personally, for the second half of the 80s, I sold free software support services. Basically, I said, for $200 an hour, I'll change whatever you want me to change in GNU software that I'd written. And yeah, it was a stiff rate, but if it was a program that I was the author of, people would figure that I might get the job done in a lot fewer hours. And I made a living that way. In fact, I made more than I'd ever made before. And I also taught classes. And I kept doing that until 1990, when I got a big prize and I didn't have to do it anymore. But 1990 was when the first corporation free software business was formed, which was Cygnus Support. And their business was to do essentially the same kind of thing I'd been doing. I certainly could have worked for them if I had needed to do that. Since I didn't need to, I felt it was good for the movement if I remained independent of any one company. That way I could say good and bad things about the various free software and non-free software companies without a conflict of interest. I felt I could serve the movement more. But if I had needed that to make a living, sure, I would have worked for them. It's an ethical business to be in. No reason I would have felt ashamed to take a job with them. And that company was profitable in its first year. It was formed with very little capital, just the money its three founders had. And it kept growing every year and being profitable every year until they got greedy and looked for outside investors, and then they messed things up. But it was several years of success before they got greedy. So this illustrates one of the exciting things about free software, which is free software demonstrates that you don't need to raise capital to develop free software. I mean, it's useful. It can help. You know, if you do raise some capital, you can hire people and have them write a bunch of software. But you can get a lot done with a small number of people. And in fact, the tremendous efficiency of the process of developing free software is one of the reasons it's important for the world to switch to free software. And it also belies what Microsoft says when they say that the GNU GPL is bad because it makes it harder for them to raise capital to develop non-free software and take our free software and put our code into their programs that they will share with us. Basically, we don't need to have them raising capital that way. We'll get the job done anyway. We are getting the job done. People used to say we could never do a complete free operating system. Now we've done that and a tremendous amount more. And I would say that we're about an order of magnitude away from developing all the general purpose published software needs of the world. And this is in a world where more than 90% of the users don't use our free software yet. This is in a world where, although in certain areas of business, you know, more than half of all the web servers in the world are running on GNU/Linux with Apache as the web server. But
I thought you said Linux.
I said GNU/Linux. Why, if I'm talking about the kernel, I call it Linux. You know, that's its name. The kernel was written by Linus Torvalds, and we should only call it by the name that he chose out of respect for the author. Anyway, but in general in business, most users are not using it. Most home users are not using our system yet. So when they are, we should automatically get 10 times as many volunteers and 10 times as many customers for the free software businesses that there will be. And so that will take us that order of magnitude. So at this point, I'm pretty confident that we can do the job. And this is important because Microsoft asks us to feel desperate. They say, the only way you can have software to run, the only way you can have innovation, is if you give us power. Let us dominate you. Let us control what you can do with the software you're running so that we can squeeze a lot of money out of you and use a certain fraction of that to develop software and take the rest as profit. Well, you shouldn't ever feel that desperate. You shouldn't ever feel so desperate that you give up your freedom. That's very dangerous. Another thing that Microsoft, well, not just Microsoft, people who don't support free software, they generally adopt a value system in which the only thing that matters is short-term practical benefits. How much money am I going to make this year? What job can I get done today? Short-term thinking and narrow thinking. Their assumption is that it's ridiculous to imagine that anybody ever might make a sacrifice for the sake of freedom. Yesterday, a lot of people were making speeches about Americans who made sacrifices for the freedom of their compatriots. Some of them made great sacrifices, even sacrificed their lives for kinds of freedom that everyone in our country has heard about, at least in some of the cases. I guess we have to ignore the war in Vietnam. But fortunately, to maintain our freedom in using software doesn't call for big sacrifices. Just tiny little sacrifices are enough, like learning a command line interface if we don't have a GUI interface program yet. Like doing the job in this way because we don't have a free software package to do it that way yet. Like paying some money to a company that's going to develop a certain free software package so that you can have it in a few years. Various little sacrifices that we can all make. And in the long run, even we will have benefited from it. You know, it's really an investment more than a sacrifice. We just have to have enough long-term view to realize it's good for us to invest in improving our society without counting the nickel and dimes of who gets how much of the benefit from that investment. I'd like to mention that there's a new approach to free software business being proposed by Tony Stanko, which he calls free developers, which involves a certain business structure which hopes eventually to pay out a certain share of the profits to every to all the authors of the free software who've joined the organization. And they're looking at the prospects of getting, I believe, some rather large government software development contracts in India now, because they're going to be using free software as the basis and having tremendous cost savings that way. And so now, I guess I should ask for questions.
You've been listening to a talk by Richard Stallman, founder of the Free Software Movement and director of the GNU Project. The talk was given at New York University School of Business late last month, thanks to the New York City Independent Media Center, another volunteer cooperative project, for this tape.
To learn more about the GNU Project and the Free Software Foundation, you can visit their website at www.gnu.org.
Your name, don't break the cycle, pass it along by word of mouth, save the world, don't leave the house, because a virtual office in a virtual home means you never have to drive through the wrong part of town. Pass it along by word of mouth, save the world, don't leave the house.
Pass it along,
don't leave the house.
Pass it along.
Security gates. Shut out the world, it's getting worse. Save yourself, don't leave the house, because a happy future is a thing of the past, and there's always another repeat. Shut out the world, it's getting worse. Save yourself, don't leave the house.
Pass it along.
Don't leave the house.
Pass it along.
Necessity, not profit, is the mother of invention. A community project in Milan has burgeoned into a nationwide phenomenon of social centers. These multipurpose facilities suggest how anarchist methods of social organization would apply to the complexities of urban life.
Three Coins in a Century Sociale by Naomi Klein. A woman with long brown hair and a cigarette-scratched voice has a question. "What does this place look like to you?" she asked, with the help of an interpreter. "An ugly ghetto or something maybe beautiful?" it was a trick question. We were sitting in a ramshackle squat in one of the least picturesque suburbs of Rome. The walls of the stumpy building were covered in graffiti, the ground was muddy, and all around us were bulky, menacing housing projects. If any of the 20 million tourists who flocked to Rome last year had taken the wrong turn and ended up here, they would have died for their tour guides and fled somewhere with vaulted ceilings, fountains, and frescoes. But while the remains of one of the most powerful and centralized empires in history are impeccably preserved in downtown Rome, it is here, in the city's poor outskirts, where I caught a glimpse of a new living politics. The squat in question is called Corto Circuito, one of Italy's many social centers. Social centers are abandoned buildings, warehouses, factories, military forts, schools, that have been occupied by squatters and transformed into cultural and political hubs, explicitly free from both the market and state control. By some estimates, there are 150 social centers in Italy. The largest and oldest, Leoncavallo in Milan, is practically a self-contained city, with several restaurants, gardens, a bookstore, a cinema, an indoor skateboard ramp, and a club so large it was able to host Public Enemy when the rap group came to town. These are scarce bohemian spaces in a rapidly gentrifying world, a fact that prompted the French newspaper Le Monde to describe them as the Italian cultural jewel. But the social centers are more than the best place to be on a Saturday night. They are also ground zero of a growing political militancy in Italy, one that is poised to explode onto the world stage when the G8 meets in Genoa next month. In the centers, culture and politics mix easily together. A debate about direct action turns into a huge outdoor party. A rave takes place next door to a meeting about unionizing fast food workers. In Italy, this culture developed out of necessity. With politicians both on the left and right mired in corruption scandals, large numbers of Italian youths have understandably concluded that it is power itself that corrupts. The social center network is a parallel political sphere that, rather than trying to gain state power, provides alternative state services, such as daycare and advocacy for refugees, at the same time as it confronts the state through direct action. For instance, on the night I spent in Rome's Corto Circuito, the communal dinner of lasagna and caprese salad received a particularly enthusiastic reception because it was prepared by a chef who had just been released from jail after his arrest at an anti-fascist rally. And 2 days before, at Milan's Leoncavallo Center, I stumbled across several members of Le Tute Bianche, the White Overalls, poring over digital maps of Genoa in preparation for the G8. The direct action group, named after the uniforms its members wear to protest, has just issued a, quote, declaration of war, unquote, on the meeting in Genoa. But such declarations aren't the most shocking things going on at the social centers. Far more surprising is the fact that these anti-authoritarian militants, defined by their rejection of party politics, have begun running for office and winning. In Venice, Rome, and Milan, prominent social center activists, including Tutte Bianche leaders, are now city councilors. With Silvio Berlusconi's right-wing Forza Italia in office, they need to protect themselves from those that would shut down the centers. But Beppe Caccia, a Tutte Bianche member and a Venetian city councilor, also says the move into municipal politics is a natural evolution of social center theory. The nation-state is in crisis, he argues, weakened in the face of global powers and corrupt in the face of corporate ones. Meanwhile, in Italy, as in Canada, strong regional sentiments for greater decentralization have been seized by the right. In this climate, Mr. Caccia proposes a two-pronged strategy of confronting unaccountable, unrepresentative powers at the global level, for example at the G8, while simultaneously rebuilding a more accountable and participatory politic locally, where the social center meets the city council. Which brings me back to the question posed in the suburbs of Rome's mummified empire. Though it may be hard to tell at first, the social centers aren't ghettos, they are windows, not only into another way of life, disengaged from the state, but also into a new politics of engagement. And yes, it's something maybe beautiful. That was Three Coins in a Century Sociale by Naomi Klein from the June 7th, 2001 edition of the Toronto Globe and Mail.
Anarchists have frequently used the internet to create collaborative projects of an international scope. One such educational project was the Anarchist FAC, which attempts to explain the ideas and principles of anarchism in a modern context. What I'm about to read is an excerpt from the Anarchist FAC. Why do anarchists support cooperatives? Anarchists support all kinds of cooperatives, housing, food, credit unions, and productive ones. All forms of cooperative are useful as they accustom their members to work together for their common benefit, as well as ensuring extensive experience in managing their own affairs. As such, all forms of cooperatives are useful examples of self-management and anarchy in action to some degree. However, here we'll concentrate on productive cooperatives, i.e. workplace cooperatives. This is because workplace cooperatives potentially could replace the capitalist mode of production with one based upon associated, not wage labor. As long as capitalism exists within industry and agriculture, no amount of other kinds of cooperatives will end that system. Capital and wealth accumulates by oppression and exploitation in the workplace. Therefore, as long as wage slavery exists, anarchy will not. Cooperatives are the germ of the future because of two facts. Firstly, cooperatives are based on one worker, one vote. In other words, those who do the work manage the workplace within which they do it, i.e., they are based on worker self-management in some form. Thus, cooperatives are an example of the horizontal, directly democratic organization that anarchists support, and so are an example of anarchy in action, even if in an imperfect way within the economy. In addition, they are an example of working-class self-help and self-activity. Instead of relying on others to provide work, cooperatives show that production can be carried on without the existence of a class of masters employing a class of order takers. Because cooperatives can survive in a capitalist economy does not automatically mean that they shall replace that economy. Isolated cooperatives, as we argued above, will more likely adapt to capitalist realities than remain completely true to their cooperative promise. For most anarchists, therefore, cooperatives can reach their full potential only as part of a social movement aiming to change society. As part of a wider movement of community and workplace unionism, with mutualist banks to provide long-term financial support and commitment, cooperatives could be communalized into a network of solidarity and support that will reduce the problems of isolation and adaptation. And that is from The Anarchist.
Now oftentimes we go there, an unwelcome guest.
If you'd like to learn more about anarchism and the ideas associated with it, you can visit the following websites. The Anarchist FAC, which is a comprehensive document compiled by anarchists from around the world to provide a thorough explanation of the ideas and principles of anarchism. You can visit the Anarchist FAC at anarchistfac.org. Again, that's www.anarchistfac.org. The Mid-Atlantic Info Shop is a popular news and information website for the anarchist community in North America. To visit the Mid-Atlantic Info Shop, go to www.infoshop.org. That's infoshop, one word, .org. Finally, if you're interested in what anarchists are doing currently worldwide, please visit the AINFO's news service. The AINFO's news service is an international, cooperatively run internet news service that has since 1995 been providing the anarchist community and other activists with useful news and information. Their website is www.ainfos.ca. That's ainfos.ca. If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
My guns and my saddle.